Castle in Cabo, California. It's January 26th, 1979. It's tape number 373A. And it looks like we're putting another month away. January is already gone. I want to do update of some news items with you that are piling up on my desk. There's too much material always, but we'll go through and do as much as we can this week. The two top news stories, of course, in my book, as far as I'm not talking about the economy and Iran and some of those other things that are very much covered in the news that you can read about at length, different viewpoints, articles being written. But from my point of view, I think the John Paisley story and the Jonestown story are of primary importance. And I don't want you to lose these clues and these bits of pieces and pieces, because I think that we have another Watergate situation here. I think it's bigger than the Korea Gate. And I think the powers that be in Washington are desperate. I think that's why Mr. Bush, formerly the CIA, wants to run for president. John Conley wants to run for president. And Ronald Reagan, whose campaign is managed by Mr. Paul Lasalt, always working with the Mormon Howard Hughes organization, the Summa Corporation. In fact, Mr. Lasalt was the man that Howard Hughes' organization wanted for president, but he is managing the money for Ronald Reagan's campaign. And we see a group of people, Gerald Ford, who was on the Warren Commission, and Howard Baker, they're all announcing their candidacy. Baker covered up the links of the Kennedy assassination to Watergate. And from what I understand, they're plenty nervous about what's going on in the John Paisley affair. I talked about it last week, and you'll hear me speaking about it at great length. I talked with Sherman Skolnick last night in Chicago, an excellent researcher, and he talked about the spy trial that was taking place in Chicago, and the subject of a payoff of $3 million was transferred to a particular gentleman because of information of the links of John Paisley to Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, for 15 years, I've been trying to get out in the open the links of Nazi Chief Reinhard Gehlen with James Angleton, with the Central Intelligence Agency, with Alan Dulles and Richard Helms, and the specific role they played in the assassination of John Kennedy. And opposed to me, and I'm positive they've always been government agents of a kind, kept showing the Abraham Zapruder film over and over and sticking to a very low-level conspiracy where there was much evidence of a much grander design, and if the cover were blown, we'd break down the entire method by which the espionage emigre community has been working with the CIA and the FBI ever since World War II. There was an article in the paper just this week, a couple of days ago, that the FBI has been asked to investigate the strange death of John Paisley. Birch Bayh, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Interesting, because he comes from Indiana, where so much of the counterintelligence programs are planned, nurtured out there, the home of the SLA and Jonestown, etc. But Birch Bayh's committee is looking into the troubling question on the death of John Paisley. They're wondering about information that he had about satellites that monitor the Soviet nuclear arsenal. And there's a comment that Paisley could figure in Senate debates on the ramification of the new Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty. And this matters whether his death had anything to do with the theft of these papers. What the article doesn't say, it's an Associated Press article, was that the apartment of Mr. Paisley, John Paisley, was completely cleaned out. They used the word sanitized, his wife, or contaminated. The apartment was contaminated by his wife when she went in there and went through his papers, and they didn't say in this Associated Press article that Marianne Paisley also works for the Central Intelligence Agency. They said that the apartment had been contaminated, and it was Mrs. Paisley who went with an agent of the Defense Intelligence and from the Defense Air Force and two members of the CIA immediately to the apartment and took out papers that they needed. Now, those agents could still be working for the Defense Department, and the problem is that they could take material that is important to the Strategic Arms Limitations Conference and blow the whole conference or the treaties that would be signed, just as the same groups managed to down Gary Power's U-2 flight and break up the peace conference between Premier Khrushchev and President Eisenhower at the time Lee Harvey Oswald was in the Soviet Union. by taking these papers and by having Mr. Paisley either be murdered or take a powder, if the papers are missing, they may say, well, we can't go into the strategic arms limitation because we don't know where these papers are, and they can accuse the Russians of taking them when they could be actually in the hands of the Defense Department. There was an article this week that was given to me by another researcher, Roger Nelson, from the North American Newspaper Alliance. Now, that's the CIA front. It was founded originally by Ian Fleming of British Intelligence, and Priscilla Johnson worked for that particular news service when Lee Harvey Oswald was in the Soviet Union, and she was working for the CIA. But they covered an article this week that said foreign-related information may be missing from the House Assassination Committee's final report on the killing of John Kennedy. The Central Intelligence Agency experts are going through material being prepared for their final report very carefully. The CIA wants some of the most sensitive stuff out of there, and they're prepared to indicate that Russian authorities have not been truthful in denials that Lee Harvey Oswald met clandestinely in Russia with KGB secret agents. The point is that the part about Yuri Nosenko, Lee Harvey Oswald in the Soviet Union, or the Hart testimony, the John Hart testimony from the CIA, may be sanitized out of the final report because the less said, the better, and they're very, very nervous about the Yuri Nosenko affair, and I'm sure that they should be. I looked up my earlier reports on the missing John Paisley, one from the San Francisco Chronicle, October the 4th, and it described how he died of a .38 caliber bullet fired against his head, and then later it was a 9-millimeter bullet. They said that he had retired from the CIA in 1974 after working for the Office of Strategic Research, and then when his boat was found after he was missing, his 31-foot sloop, it had the most complicated machinery, electronic and telephone machinery, that the national security agencies ever had, and it's not for anybody else to purchase. You have to work for the defense in order to have that. Paisley's body, according to the early article in October 74, was found, and his hands were gloved. And his son, the younger Paisley, said his father didn't own a gun, and he knew of no reason why someone would want to kill his father, but there was no inkling of how important John Paisley was to the entire Kennedy assassination. And I think that in time you're going to see the network of the white Russian community and James Angleton and Richard Helms and Alan Dulles meshing with Reinhard Galen. And because I've done so much work on that, I'm very excited about the Paisley stories breaking. They also said this week that, and this was printed before, that the body was cremated without any member of the family viewing it, which is a little unusual when you consider that at that time and for 17 days, the CIA and the FBI didn't have any fingerprints on record of John Paisley. And later they found a Jack Paisley, not a John. But for 17 days, there were no fingerprints to identify the body. It had no hair on its head or a beard. And this man had a different size shorts. John Paisley wore a 34, and the other, the body, there was a 30 shorts. Paisley weighed 175. The corpse weighed 144. And the family, without viewing the body, said, go ahead and cremate it. And I think that's pretty interesting because now Mrs. Paley has hired Bernard Fensterwald, I mentioned that last week, from the Committee to Investigate Assassinations, as her attorney, and she feels that he is alive. But the value of his disappearance, it's twofold. In the first place, he doesn't have to be around for any more questioning about the relationship of him to John Hart and Yuri Nosenko and Lee Harvey Oswald. But he also can, they can clear out his place and take the documents about the Soviet nuclear capability and foul up the SALT talks, which has been a goal for a long time, to just keep fouling up any possibility of peace talks. I looked up in Kim Philby's books the description of James Angleton, which I didn't have time to do on the tape last week. Kim Philby, for those of you who don't know the name, was a man who worked his way up to the British intelligence agencies, all the way up to the top, and then was discovered and serviced and fled to the Soviet Union and had been a Russian spy. probably their most famous spy, and he helped set up our Central Intelligence Agency, too, after World War II. There's three books on Kim Philby, My Silent Wars, The Spy I Married, and The Philby Conspiracy. I have all three, and they're very valuable. But in My Silent Wars, on page 191 and 192, he describes working with James Jesus Angleton, who's the same agent that worked with John Paisley since 1948 in counterintelligence. Kim Philby said that he worked very closely in the Office of Strategic Operations, the OSO. The driving force at that time was James Angleton. It was an intelligence gathering division for the Office of Policy Coordination. The planning division was headed by a man named Richard Helms, who later became deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency, in charge of all the CIA material with Alan Dulles at the time of the Warren Report and the investigation of the murder of the President of the United States. So you can see such a clear conflict of interest, you wonder why the Warren Report didn't ever get off the ground, particularly with the white Russian community, because Richard Helms was setting up those agents that moved to the Dallas-Fort Worth area and provided the motive for Lee Harvey Oswald and supported Marina and Lee when they came home from the Soviet Union. These were the agents of Richard Helms and James Angleton, and they were protected by Alan Dulles, who was formerly head of the CIA when all of them were hired, and also was put back on the Warren Commission. He left the CIA because John Kennedy had fired him, but his job on the Warren Commission was to clean up all the loose ends as the former director of the CIA. Kim Philby said James Angleton had very few fears about working with Germany, and this is why I make so many parallels between Nazi Germany and our National Security Council and our government today, is that working with the Nazis was their pleasure. The British and the Americans enjoyed it. Philby says in his book that they worked in Germany as a base of operation against the Soviet Union. As soon as World War I was over, Germans were armed to fight the Soviet Union. Before World War II was over, in 1943, arrangements were made to bring the Nazis all over the world and to work and form the Central Intelligence Agency. Kim Philby said the CIA took over the anti-Soviet section of the German Abwehr under Reinhard Gehlen, and Angleton defended chapter and verse the past record and current activities of the von Gehlen operation. Von Gehlen wrote in his book that after they took the war and won the war against Russia, they were going to cordon off about 30 or 40 million people and starve them immediately. And then they were going to make slaves out of another 30 or 40 million. I forget the exact figures. But Kim Philby says Angleton thought this was just fine and dandy, and that Angleton worked. And remember, all the time that I'm talking about James Angleton, he had been working since 1948 with Mr. John Paisley, and it said Angleton worked with the People's Labor Alliance, the Ukrainian fascists, the Solidaris, the Vaslov's army, and so forth. So that the James Angleton, John Paisley story will link directly to the white Russian community. And I don't want to lose track of that. I want you to think of that. Philby talks about working with Richard Helms and Angleton, how they worked with Reinhard Gehlen. And as I said last week, on the tape called The Connecting Links, that I felt all along that Alexander Zeiger, who worked in the Minsk radio factory, was a CIA agent working in the Soviet Union and a member of the Gehlen network, the Nazi network from Argentina. And it was there at that factory that he introduced Lee Oswald to Marina Oswald. Now, if all of this stays in the news and escalates, and maybe you can help me get some letters to Birch Bayh asking him to contact Mae Brussel, and I'll be writing to him this week. Let's see what we can do to smoke out these people, because the House Select Committee just finished their job, but they're left dangling, and they were very concerned on whether or not Lee Harvey Oswald was an agent of the KGB, but never addressed themselves to the question of whether he worked for the Central Intelligence Agency. They cleared the CIA of any complicity in the assassination and never addressed themselves to any single one of these agents. Now, if John Paisley pulls a Kim Philby and surfaces over at the Soviet Union and turns out to be a double agent or a spy, that, of course, would change the whole course of human history, I think, of the plans in this country to arm, align the United States with China, and make an actual hot war against the Soviet Union. I believe that if Mr. Paisley went to the Soviet Union and did line himself up, had been a double agent, and decided to live there, such as Kim Philby did when he moved over to the Soviet Union, the information that he has on the assassination of John Kennedy and the various agents that are living in this country would be enough to blackmail this country to stop any kind of warfare against the Soviet Union. It's going to take that kind of a blackmail, I believe, to stop the war and try to get along and trade and make peace with each other. It's only that kind of information, I believe, that can stop this foolishness of keep trying to go to war and aiming against each other. Another important witness that died this last week, I didn't have time to mention him on the tape, was the great Billy Lovelady. Some of you don't know his name. For other researchers, it's like a household word. Billy Lovelady, Billy Nolan Lovelady, was 41 years old when he died in Colorado last week. He's been described as a look-alike for Lee Harvey Oswald. He's the gentleman that was standing in the door of the Texas School Book Depository. He worked with Lee Harvey Oswald and was close enough to be a dead ringer, and a lot of the researchers felt that Oswald could have been the man standing at the doorway. This is a question that has never been resolved, or the coincidence of having a dead ringer for Lee Harvey Oswald standing there at the time that the motorcade was going down the street, because if Oswald were standing there, of course he couldn't have shot bullets from the sixth floor of the window, and we know he didn't fire those bullets anyway. I never did believe that was Oswald standing at the door. I think that part of the reason he accepted the job at the Texas School Book Depository was to be brought in, that he knew he'd be brought in as a patsy, and his purpose was as a decoy, rather, that he would be arrested and brought in, and then he would be released, get a lawyer. He asked for Mr. Apt, John Apt, when he was arrested, who actually had worked for the Justice Department. Lee Harvey Oswald asked for him, and I'm sure that he was promised that he'd be released with no evidence against him, and then was killed before he ever even got in touch with an attorney. But the question of this look-alike being so close that people have been confused for years was clouded by this premature death, and also just the way the whole death story was handled. The attorney for Mr. Lovelady said, yes, he died age 41, and there's no reason to have an autopsy. They think it's natural causes, although that's pretty young for natural causes. And they added, I guess this is going to stir up a lot of theories. And Lovelady's wife said that he's been harassed for 15 years. She said, I've been harassed for 15 years, and I'm not going to be harassed anymore. Well, I guess she won't, because Lovelady is now gone dead, 41 years old. One more witness that we could have maybe had a chance to examine and find out. We know that Lee Harvey Oswald had a double at the car agency, at the rifle range, at the gun shop, the barber shop, a lot of other places. And it would have been nice if Mr. Lovelady had been asked if he ever had a role in doubling for Lee Harvey Oswald. But now he's dead and no autopsy, and that's the end of Mr. Lovelady. Of course, Jonestown is in the news. I think it's the big story. It, you know, in addition to my work on the Kennedy assassination, mind control is a thing that I'm very interested in, the use of the poor, the blacks, women, aged, and also some of the very bright people that the government is experimenting on their brains. I'll talk about one of those in a few minutes. But Jonestown is still very much in the news. 70% black died, 30% white, 150 children that didn't belong to Jim Jones or anybody else. Lying about the autopsies, they're saying now that these children can't be identified. They don't know how many children belong to Jim Jones. They had a list. They had passports for every single person there. The Guyanese government had fingerprinted and taken an entrance name of every single person there. So there shouldn't be any mystery when you have a couple of hundred unidentified bodies and they're all children. But there were 150 children that they don't know who they belong to. Lying about the identification, enough drugs to do mind control jobs on many large cities several times over. The people that helped form this temple, I saw some of them. There was a rerun on the Phil Donahue show, the Grace Stone and Mr. Cordell. still very sure that Jim Jones was an egomaniac, that Jim Jones was crazy, yet Grace Jones tells how her husband wanted to be a state senator and helped Jones for a year and knew he lied about the liver being cancer, knew he beat up people, knew he beat their genitals. A man had to have a catheter. He was beat so bad. Children were whipped. Lots of punishment. She used to hold the microphone to their mouths to hear them, and they were forced to laugh when they were being beat up. These people describe all of this as not their problem, as if Jim Jones was crazy. They get on the television, they say Jim Jones was a crazy egomaniac, and yet they themselves are not being analyzed for how they helped set this up, finance it. This one, Mr. Cordell, worked for Jones for 20 years, even while Jones was in Brazil. And the cover story is Jim Jones is crazy, Adolf Hitler is crazy, Charles Manson is crazy, and Donald DeFries is. And yet, all of these people are manipulated like puppets, and the people that pull the strings are out ready for the next show. There's still a news blackout on 120, anywhere from 220 to 120 missing. We don't know where they are. And the reason this is so important is that they've been used for crimes. They've signed confession slips to federal crimes. They have said that they have assassinated persons and signed their names to it. If the figure that Jim Jones kept saying, there's 1,200 people down here, is correct, then 220 people are missing. And if Mark Lane was on Tom Snyder, if you can believe him, and he said there's 1,100 people that were there, then 120 are still missing with signed confessions. There was a building in New Jersey that just burned down. I think there were 5 or 7 members of one family, and they were from Guyana. They saw a man in the hall set fire to the building. Did these people know anything, or is it totally unrelated? Because their weapon shipments did go down from New Jersey to Guyana. The men who rented the property aren't being identified. We still don't know where they're from. Dr. Goodlett said one was from MIT. And we know that George Philip Blakey, that took that ship out the morning that the others all died, the ship holds 60 to 70 people. We don't know where they are. He went to the Barbados. The men that rented the property, I keep asking the questions, can't get any information of who they were. The Delaware, Dover, Delaware base took the bodies and didn't compare them to existing passports. The passports probably stayed in Guyana, and the bodies went up to Delaware. And the men that were there at the end, several heard, hip, hip, hooray. Mr. Clayton, I believe, was the last person when all but a few were dead. And then when the last one died, or he thought they died, he heard some men laughing and saying, hip, hip, hooray. Did those people die? Did he see their faces? Are they among the 120 that are living? If one could walk to Matthews Ridge, to a CIA base, where did the others go? Because they have the capability of doing other crimes after they left there, just like people that ran Dachau and Auschwitz could do other crimes, they should be located, but they won't be. There were 30 or 40 in the basketball team. They were Georgetown at the time that the other 910 died. But I'm adding the 910 to those people, and there's still about 120 still missing out of 1,100, and nobody is even asking where they are, even though a man from the CIA is representing 17 of these particular members of the People's Temple. Nobody asks how the CIA lawyer got into representing 17 people that survived the People's Temple murders, and they were murders. I may just be asking you these questions over and over every week. Where did the missing people go? Until we begin to get some answers. I don't know if the answers are available or not, but I may just keep asking these questions until someone comes up with the answers and we can write to public officials and say, hey, where are these people? We want their names so that later, if they're involved in murders or arson or burning buildings down or killing public officials or candidates, we want to know if they were in Jonestown. How will we ever know? If we don't know the 120 that left, how will we ever know where they are later if they're involved in the crimes that they were trained to do? The name Joseph Blatchford is the CIA man, the director of the Peace Corps. There was an article about him in May of 1972 in the New York Times that under the Nixon administration. He had worked for them, and that he intervened in 1972. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee had CIA agent E.H. Bidler Jr. on the payroll from Vista, and he wanted it taken out because he didn't want the Peace Corps to know that a man from the CIA was on it. So he himself was from the CIA, and he was instrumental in having scratched from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee information about a CIA agent, Mr. Bidler Jr. So he already has an ability to curtail information about the CIA that shouldn't be told. And now this lawyer, who was the director of the Peace Corps, a lawyer under Richard Nixon, a member of the CIA, is now representing 13 of the defectors. I don't think there's so much defectors as they ran away knowing that the deaths were going to come down. I heard one of the parties on the air the other day saying that they knew since 1973 that they were planning suicides and mass death. Well, you can hardly call children under their care suicides. And what they call defectors are people that set it all up and then split. Debbie Blakey got out, Grace Stone got out, Tim Stone, Mr. Cordell. They lost a few members of their family, George Blakey, you know, and George Phillips Blakey, the two Carters, and Mr. Rodell, Mr. Rhodes. There are a few that got out and knew when to get out, and some that were very safe in California, knowing that these deaths were going to take place. And the attorney for, as I say, for 13 of these defectors is Joseph Blatchford of the Central Intelligence Agency. Mark Lane's name is in the news, the Washington Post. George Lardner Jr., he must be loving to write this article because he hates all the researchers on the Kennedy assassination or King assassination anyway. And so it must be with glee that he writes his article in the Washington Post saying, Mark Lane's conduct in Guyana is probed. A lawyer's grievance committee in New York City has started checking into Mark Lane's conduct during the trip of Representative Leo Ryan to the People's Temple. The inquiry was touched off by a November 24th article in the Washington Post that quoted Lane as saying that he was warned beforehand that grilled cheese sandwiches served to the Ryan party might have been laced with tranquilizers or other drugs. And instead of warning anyone on the possibility, he simply didn't eat the sandwiches. A Washington attorney, Jack C. Sando, wrote court officials in New York City to question whether he should be a member of the bar of the state of New York. I don't know where Lane seems to be everywhere. I don't know if he even practices law. He flies around and represents different clients. I don't know if you have to be a member of the bar to testify for congressional committees. But even before the House Select Committee, he didn't even have Grace Walton, his client. He spoke for her, ran out of the room when it was time to speak for her. But the article goes on to say that Lane mentioned to Mr. Krause of the Washington Post, I brought along some cough drops, which have a lot of sugar in them. I sure as hell wasn't going to eat the cheese sandwiches. Lane is denying this. He says it was taken out of context. But they're asking that this be investigated because this isn't going along with the canons of the American Bar Association's Code of Professional Responsibility. I can think of 1,000 things the American Bar Association should do to disbar people, but I can't say I'm too sad about the Lane story. If he knew they were all going to die and Terry Buford went to him and Lane didn't go to Congressman Ryan, he said, you can't go into Jonestown until I go there first, and he made no effort to go out with him to the airfield, and he didn't stop him, and he didn't tell the State Department. And by that time, he and Terry Buford did, in fact, know what was coming down. And I think that's important, that they didn't go to the FBI or the Pentagon and say, fly in these planes and make a rescue and get these people out, because this is what's going to come down. The continuing inquiry, that's Penn Jones' newsletter that comes out. Penn has written 4 books, Forgive My Grief, Volumes 1, 2, 3, and 4. He lives in Midlothian, Texas. He has a newsletter if you want to subscribe to it. It's a good newsletter. In December 22nd, 1978, he has an article about Mark Lane, and he talks about his regret at having to think Lane is a double agent, but he's convinced that Lane is. And he goes into the introduction of Mark Lane to Roger Craig in Texas, the ex-sheriff that lived in Dallas, Texas, And Ben Jones had introduced him to Lane, and Lane dismissed Craig's testimony. He said it was of no consequence. The Craig testimony was one of the most important witnesses before the Warren Report, Warren Commission, because he said that Lee Harvey Oswald left the front of the Texas School Book Depository and got into a car that belonged to Michael and Ruth Payne. And that, again, goes back to the John Paisley, James Angleton, Richard Helms, John Hart connections to the Solidarist white Russian community. Mark Lane always ignored the testimony of Roger Craig and paid no heed to Marina Oswald and Ruth Payne, because this would break the story wide open. I wish that Penn and the other researchers had joined me and Sherman Skolnick in trying to expose Mark Lane a long, long time ago, and I'm sure if we had, he wouldn't have ended up down in Jonestown on another kind of an intelligence activity.